Thank you. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for the RFA, and I will be your moderator for this event and individually introduce the speakers. Then, after all have presented, we'll have time for a few questions from the audience. We appreciate those of you who stayed for this last panel of the conference, how rail safety and congestion are impacting the marketplace. Railroads are critical to the ethanol industry. The virtual pipeline moves 70% of our product to the domestic marketplace and our exporting terminals along the coast. Our industry depends on the railroads to move freight in a timely manner. We need year-round reliable pickup service, on-time deliveries, and timely returned empties to supply our clean transportation fuels across the globe. Rail transportation is a safe method for moving large quantities of ethanol long distances. The vast majority of ethanol tank cars arrive at their destinations safely without incident. Data shows that since 2006, ethanol has had over 2.4 million tank car shipments, and 99.994% of them have arrived safely at their destinations, and the statistics of the safe shipping are constantly improving as all stakeholders are committed to safety as a top priority. Today, we have an excellent panel presenting timely information concerning the challenges facing our nation's railroad network that are being created by higher demand, infrastructure needs, new rules and regulations, including the proposed tank car rules, which will affect our industry profoundly. Last winter's rail disruptions and congestion were a testament to how quickly the effects can affect the shippers. Our first speaker is Ms. Dana Lewis. She's the Chief Administrative Officer at Redfield Energy, which is a 58 million gallon a year ethanol production facility near Redfield, South Dakota. Joining Redfield Energy shortly after its formation in 2005 has given Ms. Lewis the opportunity to be involved in almost all aspects of the company's operations. From raising the initial capital involved, she's even weighed trucks coming in for corn. She manages the administrative responsibilities and serves as the industrial liaison. RFA is proud to have her on our board of directors. She holds a Bachelor of Science degree in German and Business Administration from the University of South Dakota. She is here to give us a perspective today on how directly her facility was impacted by the rail congestion that has started last winter. Please welcome Dana.
Thanks, Kelly. I will start off by saying that I tend to talk very fast, so my hope for you is that you can hear that I am speaking English and that I'm not talking so fast you can't understand me. I'll start off by giving you a little background information about our plant. We are located in northeast South Dakota. Even though our nameplate is a 40, we added an extra fermenter to the design, so we knew from the beginning that we would be able to produce around 50 million gallons. We started started producing ethanol in April of 2007, and over the past 8 years, we've been able to modify the plant enough that we currently produce around 58 million gallons. This is a 2013 map from the USDA. It shows the corn that was produced in South Dakota in 2012, and you can see the dark green counties, areas. We are one of the largest corn-growing county in South Dakota, and we are also surrounded by corn country, so we provide a very good market for our farmers. If you don't know South Dakota, we are split by the Missouri River, and we literally call these two sides West River and East River. And West River is drier. It's more suited for cattle and ranching, and East River has richer soil and is better suited for crops. So when you look at the USDA map, you can see why the majority of the corn is produced in eastern South Dakota. Some of our strategic partners are, our ethanol marketer is Eco Energy. We procure all of our corn from South Dakota Wheat Growers, who is kind of the big dog in South Dakota as far as elevators go. They buy all of our corn from the producers. All of the inventory is theirs. And then when we use the corn in the production of ethanol, we have a weigh buggy that's installed, and then we pay for what we've used from them. Our plant is served by the BNSF Railroad, and the majority of our ethanol is shipped to the Pacific Northwest. But some of it, we have a couple of trucks that go out in South Dakota. The majority of our modified distillers are shipped locally by truck to local cattle feeders and other small producers. And then some of our dry is also shipped locally, but the majority of it does go out on the rail. And before I get into any of the numbers, I will tell you that all of our financial statements are listed on our website, so everything that I tell you is already public knowledge. In calendar year 2013, we produced 57.9 million gallons of ethanol, 103,000 tons of dry distillers, 130,000 tons of modified, and we used 20.7 million bushels of corn. Now, 2014 was both a blessing and a curse to us. Our fiscal year ends August 31st. So the best fiscal year prior to last year that we had ever had was 2010. We had a $5.3 million net income. The fiscal year that just ended, August 31st, 2014, we had over a $30 million net income. And the reason we had that good financial fiscal year is also the same reason that logistically it was crazy and kind of a disaster, and that's because of the rail. For the first half of 2014, we ran our plant at various levels of production because we weren't getting our ethanol tankers back. During the calendar year, we produced 54.1 million gallons of ethanol, 87,000 tons of dry, 124,000 tons of modified, and we used 19.2 million bushels of corn. Now that's down nearly 7% of the ethanol that we produced in 2013. And even though we tried to keep our plant at a consistent level, we would look out and see where the rail cars were, and if they weren't coming back, we had to lower the rate. That meant not only did we produce less ethanol, but we produced less distillers. So our chief marketing officer really had her hands full. She had to watch where the rail cars were. She could go out online and see where the rail cars were. She had to look at the commitments we had made, and she had to look at the inventory we had on hand. And it was tough to balance all three of those. Our risk management team includes employees, some board members, and outside strategic partners, and they really had to stay on top of those things. They met often. We try to meet once a month, but they met a lot more during that time. Fortunately, we have a fabulous relationship with Eco Energy, and we talk to them more than once a day, and they really stayed on top of things to help us at least stay producing. We had made several commitments prior to the rail slowdown, and then when the rail cars weren't coming back for both ethanol tankers and hopper cars, we had to go out to the market and buy some spot product. So even though we did have a $30 million net income, we could have had more. We try not to look at it like that, but it was tough to see those cars not coming back and then have to go out and buy some ethanol or distillers that were higher priced. So once that happened, we learned that we needed to be extra cautious in pre-selling product to customers at fixed prices because we couldn't be sure that those rail cars were going to come back on time. At normal production, we fill 40 ethanol tankers per week. 2014, we averaged 34 tankers per week, and we filled them as soon as they came in. So our grain handlers were very busy. If they came in during the week, they filled them. If they came in at night or on the weekends or on a holiday, they came in and filled them. We had to get those tankers out. So the 34% is 84% of the 40 tankers that we expect. Not only that, the rail cars usually come back in 4 weeks. But once the rail troubles began, they weren't coming back for an average of 7 weeks. So the third problem with that was that we usually get 3 days a week service, but with the rail slowdowns, we were only getting 2 day a week service. One of the most frustrating parts for us was going out online and seeing our filled rail cars sitting 40 miles away. We even had two rail cars that were shipped that came back to us completely full. So I can't remember the number of weeks that they were gone, but we'll use the five weeks average. They went out for 5 weeks, came back filled. We had to turn around and ship them out again for another 5 weeks, and we didn't have two cars to spare, let alone for that long. We understand that all of the issues that BNSF has for not getting our rail cars back on time, they put in a lot more tracks. When you're in a car and you have a detour, you go around the section or a couple sections, and it doesn't take very long. But on the rail, it does. One of the other problems was lack of manpower. They've hired thousands of new people in the Midwest alone. They also had record volumes of product being moved. But we also believe that one of the bigger factors for us was the rail cars going to the Bakken. According to the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources, in 2012, North Dakota produced 243 million barrels of oil. That's an average daily production of 728,000. In 2013, that number was 313 million barrels for an average daily production of 938. And then in 2014, it was 396 million barrels, so daily production of over a million barrels per day. And I didn't take the million barrels versus the 728,000 barrels per day is 359,000 barrels per day. Now, I didn't take how many barrels that would be in those entire 3-year time frame, but I do know that one rail car can hold approximately 700 barrels of oil. So if you take the 359,000 divided by 700, that's an extra 512 rail cars every day. So you can't take that many rail cars out of the market and expect that no one else is going to notice. Besides shipping on the rail, our truck sales were also affected for our local producers. Winter is our high demand, and that's when the plant was slowed down the most. In the summer, if the hopper cars don't show up, then we have to sell the feed to the local producers at a discount because they really don't need it, but they'll take it. And we regularly had to call producers to either cancel loads because we weren't getting the rail cars back or to come and get extra loads. After its April hearing in Washington, D.C., the Surface Transportation Board asked the railroads to put a higher priority on fertilizer shipments. And then after that, they asked the railroads to do what they could to catch up on the grain orders. Now, we're a value-added ag entity, so we were okay with that because our producers needed to get the fertilizer in order to ensure a better crop, and then they had to catch up on the grain shipments so that when harvest came this last fall, they weren't still catching up from that. The downside was that it put ethanol producers even further down the totem pole. In the first quarter of 2013, we loaded 500 rail cars. Compare that to the first quarter of 2014, we loaded 454, which is 91% of the previous year. The second quarter, we loaded 528 in 2013 versus 415 in the second quarter of 2014. So once the first two quarters were over, that's when everyone had their crops in, and then the fertilizer too, and the railroads were able to catch up a little bit. And so you can see that we were still down 5% in the third quarter, 4% in the fourth quarter, and overall for the year we were down 10%. Our worst week was the week ending March 16th. We loaded 16 of 40 rail cars. The second worst week was May 25th. We loaded 19 of 40 rail cars. But then on the other hand, May 11th and June 15th, we got 51 rail cars in. So it's very hard to run your plant. If you look at those last three dates, they're all within 5 weeks. So May 11th, we had 51. May 25th, we had 19. And then June 15th, we were back to 51 again. It's really hard to manage your sales when it's just so up and down. For a week in January, we ran our plant at 84% of our normal production. That was starting January 2nd. For 7 weeks, we ran the plant at 95%. Starting March and then through the end of February and then March, it was 68%. And then for 4 months, from March through July, we were at 84%. And then from July through the end of the year, we were back up to 100% of our planned production. That's just a lot of ups and downs for our plant. Because of all these issues, we added some extra storage, on-site storage. We started with two 750 million gallon tanks, so we had a total of 1.5 million. We added two 1 million gallon tanks. Those weren't actually able to be used until about our fall shutdown, which is was the beginning of September. They had to be certified. They were done in August. They had to be certified. So we haven't really used those tanks, but we definitely wish we would have had them earlier in the year. These next two slides just show the weather in South Dakota. And if you're not from South Dakota, it's very cold there. This week, today, yesterday and today were warmer. Yesterday was 19. Today is supposed to be in the 40s, but next week is supposed to get back down colder again. But before yesterday, our high of the week was 9. And so these are the first 6 months, and then these are the last 6 months. We have six, almost 7 months of the year where our average low is below freezing. We just can't afford to shut down our plant in those temperatures. Fortunately, as I said, once the July hit, things did pick back up, and we were able to ramp up our production. We did not have to use those ethanol storage tanks, but we're definitely glad we put them in. Even with the extra storage tanks, we still would have had to slow down the plant. We produced 4 million gallons less than the year before. Our extra storage tanks were only 2 million gallons. So we still would have had to slow down, and they would have helped, but they weren't a fix-all to all of our problems. We're very fortunate to have Senator John Thune working on our behalf. He's been in Redfield. He's heard our story many times. In April, he tested before the Surface Transportation Board at their hearing, and he used many of the statistics from our plant. In September, I testified before the Surface Transportation Board, and we feel that both Senator Thune and the Surface Transportation Board have heard our concerns, and they're doing what they can to help us. And as I said earlier, EcoEnergy has just been a very good partner for us, and they worked with us so we didn't have to shut down the plant and to get our ethanol into the market. We do have a very good relationship with our local BNSF crew. They were very empathetic to us. They just couldn't help us. So planting season is not very far away. We're hopeful that things will go pretty good. We've had pretty good luck since July. So the rail cars are coming back at a decent pace. We'll see how things go this spring. We do have the extra storage in place, so if we need to use it, we will. And again, if we need to add more storage, we will do that as well. All we can do is just keep running our plant the way that we know how, be proactive, and do what's best for us. So thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing, and I think that explicitly shows you how critical rail is to our business. Our next speaker will go more in depth into this congestion issue and examine the issue more closely, and he'll also describe some new tools that are available through the STB, the Surface Transportation Board, that we can use for the future. Todd Traduski is Argus's North American Transportation Editor based in Washington, D.C. He is responsible for editing the weekly Argus Coal Transportation Newsletter, along with overseeing the Argus Rail Business publication that focuses on rail and shipper dynamics, critical rate data, rail costs, as well as regulatory and operational issues within the rail industry. He also accesses rail and barge rates for the movement of petroleum products for Argus Petroleum's transportation report. Mr. Traduski graduated from Temple University with dual degrees in history and journalism. Let's please welcome Todd.
All right, good morning. As Kelly said, I am Todd Traduski, and I'm with Argus. Well, before we begin and get too far into it, let's talk about who Argus is, what Argus does. We publish a bunch of price assessments all across the world for energy commodities as well as transportation. We've gone from transportation, we've grown into the metals and fertilizers space as well to get into those markets and kind of diversify ourselves. We have over 700 people all across the globe working to get these assessments out. And some of our publications, we have the U.S. Products Report, we have the U.S. Biofuels Report that look particularly at the markets. What is the cost of moving commodities in those markets? What are the costs of the commodities in those markets? And then the Petroleum Transportation North America report that looks at what does it cost to move the commodity from point A to point B, because that is so important for all of these different commodities. But let's jump into what we're really here to talk about today, and let's talk about congestion and its effects on the ethanol market. Well, what are the challenges? Of course, everybody in this room is familiar with last year's challenges and what all went into last year's challenges that made it almost impossible for many ethanol shippers to get their products to market. This year has been better, but all is not over. These issues have not cycled themselves. They're not to a point where we can feel comfortable that they're going to stay at the levels they are. And when you look at how ethanol is doing against other commodities, well, it's faring worse. And we'll get into some data that shows how we can tell that it's faring worse. And, of course, Tom's going to get into tank cars in more depth, but no presentation about the rail issues would be complete without at least some conversation of the issues in the tank car market. So last year's issues with winter have created a long hangover well into this year, where folks had trouble getting product out of the Midwest from the production facilities to markets. As Bob talked about yesterday morning, you know, a snowdrift in South Dakota, you know, kind of cascaded through the supply chain. But it wasn't just the weather. The railroads had their own issues with locomotives and crews to be able to handle the volume increases. They thought the volume was temporary. They didn't look at it as continuing throughout the year, and that made it very hard for them to catch up once the snows hit. There really wasn't an ability or a surge capacity to deal with the problem. There weren't the extra crews in place that once things went south to get the network back to functioning at the level that the railroads and all the shippers expected it to. And that created price differentials and price problems. What I've shown you here is the spread in ethanol prices that Argus assesses between Chicago and the New York Harbor market that was one of the most acutely affected last winter. And as folks in the ethanol market know, that spread's generally driven by transportation cost. And you can see when the railroads went through the worst of their struggles, the spread between the regions really blew itself out and got to a point where if you had product in that market, you could get a premium, and if you couldn't, you had to try and figure out a way to get it there. And of course, what that shows us is that Chicago was the primary choke point. That was really the epicenter of where things started and radiated out from there, because they are network businesses. And Chicago is crucial for ethanol because it's the primary interchange hub for anything trying to go east. If you're going to load ethanol in South Dakota, in Omaha, in Iowa, it's going to go through Chicago on its way east. And Chicago is a huge terminal. It's a lot of switching. It's very congested, even on a good day, even before you throw snow and cold and wind chills into the mix. It doesn't function well already. And what last year really kind of solidified for railroads is the need to try and get traffic out of Chicago. If it's not going to be destined in Chicago, move it around. Use places like East St. Louis, Illinois, like Memphis, Tennessee, even New Orleans in some cases, to move that traffic away from Chicago. And all, in addition to that, where New Orleans is particularly out of route for some ethanol shipments, you could also take it and block cars and switch cars away from Chicago, so that even if you wanted to run the train through Chicago, you would handle all of your switching at an outlying point at North Platte, Nebraska, at Omaha, at as far away as Houston in some cases, and give it to the eastern carriers where they could work it at places like Indianapolis, places like Columbus, places that were not Chicago, so that you could run the train through Chicago without having to deal with the switching and the terminal issues. But, as I said, it wasn't just a Chicago issue. Being that we're here in Grapevine, I thought it would be instructive to look at the spread between ethanol in Chicago and ethanol in Dallas. And you can see that just like the New York Harbor spread, it blew out last year when things got bad for the railroads. It didn't go to quite the same degree as the New York Harbor market, but you could certainly notice the difference in prices between the two regions, even though that traffic generally doesn't touch Chicago. So performance and recovery is better in some locations, but not everybody's seeing that. It's really kind of a spotty recovery. It's in places or on particular railroads, so some shippers might see it, some shippers might not. As Dana said, the Surface Transportation Board's been focused on these issues. They held a number of hearings last year to talk about the issues and try to figure out what they could do. And they settled on increased data to get more data from the railroads that shippers could use to make decisions. And the reaction to it's quite frankly been mixed. Some shippers like the visibility into the railroads world. Some of them look at it as data for data's sake that isn't really valuable, or they don't know how to make use of it for their businesses. Well, the Surface Transportation Board really isn't willing to go beyond what they've already done. They're really unwilling to take the big tool out of their toolbox, the emergency service order, and use it. And they don't want to use it for a lot of good reasons, because they're afraid that using it for one commodity will shift the issue to another commodity or to another region and simply shift the problem instead of dealing with the problem. If they were to give it for ethanol, what would that do to coal trains trying to move across the network and vice versa? But the new data is good because it allows shippers to take a look at things and decide what they want to do. As we move on here, if the clicker will let me, you'll see that velocity's improving, but it's a work in progress. These charts are from the Surface Transportation Board's new data, and what they show is the velocity of ethanol trains over the last several months. You've got the Western Railroads on the left, Eastern Railroads on the right, and you can see it's a mixed bag. BNSF, clearly better than they were 3 months ago. Union Pacific, not really. And in the East, you've got a similar split, where CSX, clearly better. They've gone down lately as they've had to face more weather issues on the East Coast, as Boston and New York and Buffalo have found out in recent months, but they're certainly better than they were 3 months ago. Norfolk Southern, it's been choppier. It hasn't been quite as clear-cut on the improvement. Of course, but it's not just velocity. Dwell times show that issues remain in the network. This data is Association of American Railroads data. That's why it's hard to have the same geographic area for both railroads and provide a true comparison. We're dependent on the data the railroads release. But I've tried as best I can to give you a comparison that is normalized for weather and normalized for the volumes that go through the yards. And you can see that dwell times have been all over the place. Obviously, last year, things got bad. And for the Eastern Railroads, they're, in a lot of cases, still bad. You know, the improvement has been incremental. It's been geography-based. Not everybody has seen it. So the question becomes, why, as an ethanol producer, why, as an ethanol shipper, do you care about how long railroad cars dwell in yards? Well, it's because they're a leading indicator that an issue is coming. If the railroads are honest about it, all of their capacity starts in the yards. If they cannot move trains through the yards efficiently, then they can't get trains off of their main lines into those yards. And as that happens, as more trains sit on main lines, the crews hit their hours of service limit under federal law and need to be replaced. If that train sits on the main line, suddenly that's less main line capacity for every train moving across that region. Even if it doesn't necessarily touch that yard, if it touches that line and moves through that region, it will feel the effects of that. As that starts to happen, velocity declines, and you notice that your cycle times go from 5 days to 7 days, 7 to 10, and it becomes, you know, it snowballs, pardon the pun. And of course, congestion isn't just affecting carriers in terms of higher unit cost, higher cycle times, lower asset utilization. Railroads see an effect of this too. Suddenly, their operating plan, their network plan for resources, for locomotives and crews that they had in place that they thought would be sufficient to handle the volume, isn't. As your recrew ratio goes up, you suddenly need more employees and more locomotives to move the same amount of volume. There's a cost to that. Railroads have, in past years, gotten better at increasing the amount of surge capacity they have, but it's not perfect. And when you're talking about high-cost, long-lived assets, the railroads have always kind of been behind the investment curve, even as they've increased capital expenditures dramatically over the last decade. They're always going to be a little bit behind that investment curve because of the fact they don't want to make a mistake. But as service went downhill, you would expect that you'd be paying less to move your shipments. Well, that hasn't happened. I've indexed this slide to January of 2013. And you can see that rail rates to Chicago and rail rates to Houston have both gone up over that time. Chicago more dramatically so than Houston, but they both increased. So even as service has gone down, you're not necessarily seeing that in the price you're paying to the railroad. You're paying more to the railroad and getting less service. And maybe that's just across the board. Maybe that's because the railroads are having ongoing congestion issues across the network and everybody's being affected. Let's take a look at how ethanol fares compared to other traffic groups. Again, from the new Surface Transportation Board data, one too far. How the Surface Transportation Board data, how ethanol fares compared to other commodities. This is crude. And this is not a perfect comparison because the sizes of the ethanol business and the crude business are not the same. But what this shows you is how long, once a unit train of crude is loaded and once a unit train of ethanol is loaded on the railroads, how long does it wait to be dispatched? How long does it wait at origin before it moves for a crew in power to take that train away? And you can see with BNSF on the left and UP on the right that in every case, ethanol trains have waited longer than crude trains. Now, maybe that's because railroads have more crews in crude areas and other commodities will look differently. Let's look at ethanol and a non-petroleum commodity. Let's take grain, for instance. Again, not a perfect comparison because the size of the ethanol business and the size of the grain business are different. But unit train to unit train, generally, ethanol trains are waiting longer once they're loaded on a unit basis than grain trains are. And of course, I said no presentation would be complete without talking about tank cars, so let's do that. Everybody's waiting for a final rule. The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration has said that the final rule date that they have out there in May is not firm. We know that the rule is at the Office of Management and Budget. Nobody knows exactly what's in the rule. They know what the options were that came out to industry. They know that it's at OMB. We do not know what the effects of recent accidents might be. We do not know what OMB's timeline is for getting it out. What we do know is that most ethanol today is not moving in CPC 1232 cars. It's moving in the older DOT 111 cars. That's changed a little bit as crude prices have come down. Some of the crude shippers have looked for homes for their cars and they flowed back into the ethanol space. But we're still not at a place where a majority of ethanol moves in CPC 1232 cars. The one thing we know for sure about the rule is that it's going to raise costs for everybody. Everybody that uses tankers, whether you're an ethanol shipper or a crude shipper, you're going to have higher costs. You're going to have lower carrying capacity out of the car because it's going to be heavier as you put more steel on it. And depending on the timeline, it could create a real problem in terms of shop capacity to make the repairs and retrofits that need to be made. And folks aren't doing anything right now. A bad rule would almost be better for the industry than no rule at all, because shippers are not going to invest in a car that could be obsolete in a few years, and lessors are looking at it from a liability perspective, where at least one lessor has been told by their attorneys not to go in and make any kind of retrofits at all to cars, because if they retrofit some cars and then a non-retrofitted car is involved in an accident, they could open themselves up to some additional liability, and they don't want to do that. So as we wait for the rule to come out, everybody's kind of in a holding pattern, just waiting to see what the government's going to require. And so wrapping up, obviously the weather this year has helped the carriers create better service, but it's not across the board. Ethanol prices are affected by the rail issues. If you can't move product into a market, you either have to have looked at the data and anticipated it and moved product into the forward markets before the real crush occurs, or you have to be prepared to look at other ways to service your commitments in those markets. And the STB data shows that while not perfect comparisons, ethanol is faring worse than a lot of other commodities out there. And of course, everybody's focused on the tank car rule and what it's going to mean to their cost and what it's going to mean to their ability to be in this space. And thank you. And as Kelly said earlier, we'll take all our questions at the end.
Thank you, Todd. That was a very nice presentation and very nice data. Next on the agenda was Mr. Tim Butters, who is the acting administrator of the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. But unfortunately, he had a medical emergency, and any remaining staff is currently busy with the most recent crude oil derailment that happened Monday in West Virginia. 7 months ago, as Todd referenced, FSMA, in coordination with the FRA, issued an NPRM that affects shipping ethanol by rail. And proposed are these new operational requirements and standards related to the workhorse of our industry, the DO2-111 tank car. They are at the White House now. They were sent there 2 weeks ago. This has been a pretty fast-tracked regulation. Our industry is very concerned about these pending rules. If not carefully constructed, they could have far more reaching negative effects than we ever experienced during the polar vortex. Could these new tank car rules cause disruption and economic problems for our industry? Well, here today to discuss these possibilities is Thomas Simpson. He is president of the Railway Supply Institute, the trade association for the rail supply industry. RSI represents nation's leading companies involved in the manufacture of products and the services in the freight car, tank car, locomotive maintenance and communications, signaling, and passenger rail industries. In 2013, he celebrated 25 years with RSI and his predecessor organizations. He has a BA in history from Lafayette College and a master's in public administration from the American University. Please welcome Tom.
KD, you're the best. I'm the my most favorite baseball team, the Washington Nationals. Pitchers and catchers reported yesterday. So in the tradition of baseball, I'm batting last for the Renewable Fuels Association on your conference here. So, and I'm happy to do it. What I do, press the green button here. That's how excited I am. You heard about the Railway Supply Institute. Think locomotives, freight cars, passenger cars, maintenance of way equipment. And we have 12 companies that own and provide for lease over 700,000 freight cars. And these are the members of the RSI Committee on Tank Cars. They build 95% of the tank cars operating in North America, and they own and lease some 70%. There are companies that belong to RSI that don't belong to the Tank Car Committee, but own and lease tank cars, like First Union, like Chicago Freight Car Leasing. So my organization and the companies that belong to my organization own and provide for lease over 70% of the tank cars. It's been a tough couple of weeks for those of us in the tank car industry. Accidents in the industry, in the railroad industry, have a tendency to be identified by where they happened. Meganic is a prime example as to why our nation's schools need to teach French better, because not one person pronounces it the same way as the other person. In addition to that, of course, we had a recent incident in Dubuque, Iowa, Crow's Nest Pass out in western Canada, Gogama in northern Canada. I happen to be on the Via Rail Canada's Canadian, which goes from Vancouver to Toronto the week before, not this past weekend, but the week before. And that train goes through Folliette and Gogama in the daytime. And luckily we made it. Otherwise, we'd be sitting up there eating Via Rail food still, although the line is open, I hear. There is nothing up in that part of the world. There is nothing in northern Ontario. And I know that they had trouble getting in there. They were ferrying people in by locomotive and other kinds of cars. There are no roads up there. There's no cell service up there. There's no nothing up there. So, and then, of course, last week and also in West Virginia. A point about tank cars, and I know this is a fine point, but tank cars in a fire have a tendency to have a thermal tear, and then the commodity goes. Tank cars themselves don't explode. They're not rolling time bombs. They're not pentos on rails. They operate safely every day of the year throughout North America. They do not spread tank car shrapnel all over West Virginia or all over northern Ontario or all over Dubuque, Iowa. So perhaps a fine line, but perhaps a fine line that our friends in the press ought to understand. Tank cars, most of you have probably seen this because I've given the same presentation now for about a year, but there are some nuances to this that are a little bit different. We track freight car orders and deliveries by type. When you see those in the press, they come from my office. This is the decade of the 80s and into the 90s. Tank cars were historically an 8 to 12,000 unit a year business. Freight cars don't, the freight cars vary depending on the economy and mergers and things like that. Let me see now. This is the 2000s. And you can see tank car or delivery spiked in the 2005 to 2008 time period. They're spiking again. Last year we built 35,000 railroad tank cars, the most we've ever built in modern history. The current backlog for tank cars, I'll get to that in a second, is some 57,000. The current backlog for freight cars is 125,000. There is, I go back, our records go back into the dim recesses of the 1970s. We've never seen a backlog of all freight cars ordered but not yet delivered of 125,000. That's almost a tenth of the fleet. We have cars on order that approximate almost a tenth of the fleet. The reason I point out 2006 to 2008 and 2009 is that those cars are coming for requalification. A tank car needs to be requalified every 10 years. Those cars are coming up for requalification, and thus tank car shops, and only a certain number of shops can work on tank cars. You've got to be certified by the AAR and all those kinds of things. Tank car shops are chock-a-block full of cars that are awaiting requalification. This is my eye chart, along with everybody else's eye chart. You would be amazed in the aftermath of Meganic that none of us really knew how many cars were out there. And we sat in the meeting at the Association of American Railroads. We had taken a guess that some 40 to 45,000 tank cars in crude oil service, and we were pretty close. These are the cars in flammable and combustible liquid service. As of last May, 110,000 cars in all flammable and combustible liquid service, 48,500 in crude, 27,845 in ethanol. I'm going to get to an economic study that we have commissioned that has some interesting results. This is some work that our economists did with our car builders. This is the projected flammable liquids tank car fleet at the end of 2015. This includes the current fleet and additions of new cars. 87,000 in crude oil, 28,000 in ethanol, and another 40,000 almost in other flammable liquids. When the PHMSA rule goes through, each one of these cars will either have to be removed from service or will undergo some kind of modification. Our estimate is that not all the non-jacketed legacy DOT 111s, those are the older cars, median build date in the late 90s, our estimate is that some 28% of those will get thrown out, which is not right terminology, but are not subject for modification and will either be retired or cascade into some other kind of service. So I can't do the math, but you know, some 16, 17,000 crude oil cars, some whatever 70% of 27,000 is. Those are the numbers of cars that are going to have to, of the non-jacketed DOT 111s, legacy cars that we think are subject to modifications. And of course, that decision is made by the car owner, not by me, not by the Department of Transportation, not by Transport Canada. But the car owner will determine whether it's worth to him or he or she to have the car modified. You know, a tank car is a 50-year asset, and so these cars are all relatively new, built within the last 15 to 20 years. This is, again, my eye chart. This is the number of tank cars that need to go through, that need to be requalified. If you do the math between 2015 and 2020, it's a couple of 100,000 tank cars that will be in railroad, it will be in shops being requalified, and that is the problem. If for modifying the current fleet, we've got to find shop space to handle not only this but the modification of the fleet as determined by whatever the PHMSA rule says. We represent the new car builders, and this is the math on new cars. We think that the total capacity for the next 3 years is 105,000 cars based on 35,000 built last year. That's the current backlog, almost 60,000 cars. So in the next 3 years, the capacity, assuming that you build a backlog, the capacity is 47,000. We think 60% of that is available for new cars for crude and ethanol. There are other reasons to buy tank cars, you know, whether it's chlorine or whether it's clay slurry or whatever, and so there are other types of tank cars going through railroad car builders' shops, not just new tank cars for crude and ethanol and other flammable liquids. This is not a silver bullet here. New cars are not going to replace the current fleet. They're going to add to the current fleet. Here's our proposal. I'll go through it real quickly. That we sent this to, we spent hundreds and hundreds of hours developing this. Sent it to DOT last summer for new cars, 9/16 inch for crude and ethanol service, which was option two, 7/16 inch for the other commodities. Jacket, full height head shields on the end of the cars, top fitting protection, and reconfigured bottom outlet valve handle that is being developed by the AAR Committee on Tank Cars, pressure relief valve, normalized steel, and a thermal protection system that meets the 100-minute pool fire requirement. We have suggested to the Department of Transportation and will suggest to the White House that ECP brakes are not a needed addition to the rulemaking we don't think that they add appreciably to the safety of moving these trains when we can have two-way end-of-train devices or distributed power. This is our modification proposal. CPC 1232 car, as it turns out, undertaken voluntarily by the industry with cars built after October 1st, 2011, is an interim car because we will have a new car design as dictated by the Department of Transportation, and we will have additions to the current CPCs to remove the risk of moving crude and ethanol by rail. We're advocating for a jacket, full height head shield, and the usual stuff. It's important, too, that we harmonize between Canada and the United States. Tank cars operate throughout North America, so tank car requirements should be the same. Harmonization is important to us. We've told both Transport Canada that and our USDOT that. Let me see where we are here. This is an estimate of the cost. We did this 18 months ago maybe, so you've probably seen this, so the cost, we're still good with these. This is the cost sheet that we've delivered to the Department of Transportation. We went to our car owners and with a worksheet. Each of them had the same worksheet. Each of them was working from the same premises. if that's the right, is that the plural of premise? And so this is obviously scrubbed, but this is the numbers that we came up with and the numbers that we are happy with. $16,000 to add a jacket, $23,000 to add a full height head shield. So you go through one of the big numbers is whether you need a truck upgrade or not, and we're working through the AAR on that process. But you know, it's going to cost to have these cars modified, and the RSI Committee on Tank Cars is willing to absorb this cost to continue to remove risk from the movement of hazardous materials by rail. We hired this company, the Brattle Group, I guess it's called, and our chief economist was an economist from Cornell University. I grew up in Ithaca, New York, so I was happy to see that my hometown was represented. My parents went to Cornell. Of course, I couldn't get in, so that's the difference between my parents and this economist and me. I've taken the same economics course four times and gotten the same grade every time, so I am telling you I am not an economist. But I will report on the findings of our economic team. This is based on our RSI proposal that I just gave you, and also the timeline that was proposed by our DOT. The timeline was PG1 by 2017, PG2 by 2018, PG3 by 19 or 20. I can't remember exactly what the last ones were. So this is based on the DOT proposed timeline and our proposed modification, schedule. So you saw the fleet estimate. As we said, we think 28% of the legacy DOT 111 fleet will face early retirement. We presume that all existing tank cars are going to be modified in some way, shape, or form. The older cars with more work being done than the newer CPC cars. Also, unlike what DOT suggested, we don't think, and Canada told us, that these cars aren't going to be transferred to Canadian oil sand service. Our economic team guesses that at various points during the modification program, a total of 103,000 tank cars would be idled awaiting modification. Our economists think that FEMSA underestimated the time necessary to carry out the required modifications, and the draft RIA does not account for transportation impacts. We have surveyed the shops. And those shops chock-a-block full of cars that are awaiting requalification. They have told us that they think, and we have calculated that we think they can add another 550 cars a month to their current capacity to do the modification work that we think this rule is going to require. Let me see if I get to that. I don't know that I get to that or not, but here I do get to that. There is not enough capacity in the shops to do the work that FEMSA assume needs to be done. They're assuming roughly 16,000 cars a year. We think that the shops that we've surveyed, which are virtually all the shops in North America, are closer to 6,500 additional cars a year. So there is a delta there that can't be reached by our shop estimates as opposed to FEMSA's shop estimates. We think that there's going to be a six-month ramp-up period, 72 months to do the legacy cars, 96 months to do the CPC non-jacketed, and then 120 months to do the rest of the fleet. It's going to take 10 years, we think, given the current shop capacity, to get all this work done. So Brattle then looked at what the alternatives were, and the alternatives are either oil will stay in the ground, or it will move by tank truck, and specifically for ethanol, the loss of tank car capacity would mean, according to our economists, an increase in shipper costs above $1 billion through 2021, because those tank cars that you guys use may very well be sitting idle a waiting for shop capacity that's not there and are not allowed to operate per the DOT rule. 100 million barrels of ethanol production are potentially stranded according to our economic model. So the safety and environmental impacts, I'll go through this real quick. More trucks on the road, we all know what that means. Trucks will travel on major highways. Truckers spill more than railroads do, and the environmental consequences are such. The unintended consequences, a million total car years for the fleet during the modification, 28% that are going to be retired, $3 billion in total direct compliance costs, $300 and $100 million the number of barrels of oil and ethanol stranded. That is what we think the proposed DOT rule will do to my industry and to your industry. If Mr. Butters were here, he would tell you that his team has received thousands of comments on the proposed rule. They've been working day and night, and as indicated earlier, they have sent a final rule to the White House for approval. What we hear via the press, I don't have as good sources apparently as the press, that the high-hazard flammable train concept, which is cuts of cars, certain number of cars together become a high-hazardous flammable train, we hear that is still in the rule. We think that any car is eligible to become a high-hazard flammable train car, and so every car is going to have to be modified nevertheless. We also hear there might be ECP brakes on unit trains. An unexpected, unintended, unneeded cost, some $8,000 to $9,000 per car. The costs accrue to the car owner, the benefits, if any, accrue to the railroads. The railroads would tell you that they would need to ECP capable locomotives, and that's an extremely expensive proposition as well for a relatively little return on the investment. We also hear the timeline might have been expended a little bit. So, and if that's the case, then there is actually somebody listening to us at the Department of Transportation. Thanks for that. I'll answer any questions along with my panel.
Thank you, Tom. House lights up. We do have a time for a few questions since Mr. Butters wasn't here. So if you want to step up to the microphone, we'd welcome them. End of the day. Any questions?
Tom, this is Brad Brunner from Glacial Lakes Energy up in Watertown. See, I noticed on one of your slides that it mentioned, I think I saw 40,000 rail cars for the crude oil industry, and there was about 27,000 cars for the ethanol industry. And yet, when you look at the percent of the fuel supply that comes from ethanol, obviously at about 10%, how do you explain the slower turn time for the ethanol industry versus the crude oil industry?
Are we talking railroad service issues, or are we talking something else here?
Basically, the railroad service. You had mentioned that, I think on your slide you showed turn times.
I did not. I just didn't prior slide.
I showed velocities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Velocities and hold times. But basically, it just looks like, you know, the railroads are looking at prioritizing certain groups over other groups. And when those spreads between those numbers are really, really wide in terms of the hours being held, clearly it's more than just a geographical issue. Clearly they're allocating a certain way to move certain traffic quicker than others. You know, how the railroads make those decisions is really kind of a railroad by railroad decision based on, you know, moving the highest yielding traffic. And so, you know, getting better attention from your railroad, I think, just comes down to, you know, making the case that, you know, that the business is going to be there and that you're you know, a reliable supplier of business to them, and getting them business in ways they want to handle it, like unit trains, like if they have particular commitments in your contract and not take power off of the train, hitting those commitments, so that you give the railroad every incentive to work with you and move your train as efficiently across the network.
I see nobody else at the microphone. So in closing, I'd like to say that safe transportation of ethanol by rail has been and will continue to be a top priority for our industry. We'll continue to work with PHMSA, Transport Canada, RSI, and other stakeholders to ensure that ethanol by rail transportation is safe and efficient. Let's have one more round of applause for our excellent speakers. Thank you.
Thank you all. I would just note quickly, Tom Simpson with the Railway Supply Institute offices in our building. He is directly below Ed Hamburger and the American Association of Railroads, and I am directly above Ed's office. And so between the two of us, Ed doesn't stand a chance.
None of us stand a chance. Above Bob is Disney. Bob's got a baseball bat in his office, I think, and he periodically bangs the floor so Ed can hear him. And I've got a baseball bat in my floor, but I'm beneath Ed, so I can't bang him to get his attention. But Disney is on the 12th floor, so they lord over all of us.
Yes, they do. I just want to say in closing, thank you all very much for being here. I think we've had some great discussions. I appreciate your participation. I appreciate the support that you give the association in this conference. But there's one person in particular. These things just don't happen. And I need to publicly thank Mary Giglio for making the NEC what it is. Mary, you're the best. She will quickly say, oh, no, I had lots of help. And indeed, she did. Chris Finley and Missy Ruff and Ann Lewis on my staff also played critical roles this year. And I want to thank them as well and the others on my staff. But Mary's the straw that stirs the drink on this event, and I thank her. So next year we are in New Orleans, and I hope to see you all there. Travel safe. Thank you very much.